Chapter 4. Usable Rage, Love, Justice, Creativity. For many years, every student, colleague or friend seemed to be urging me to read Elena Ferrante. I'd be hooked from the start, they would assure me. No writer was as brave, as wrenching, as startlingly truthful about the perils of human intimacy. Much as they piqued my curiosity, they also aroused that peculiar awareness that comes with being told what to read, watch, or listen to. Besides, there is always too much to read, always another author threatening to wedge herself into the tottering pile of good intentions. I figured I'd get to her at some point. As it happened, she got to me instead, one late November weeknight in 2021. I was already in bed and reading someone else when my wife returned home and looked at me with an unseeing stare that unsettled me enough to ask her if she was all right. She furrowed her brow an inch or two off direct eye contact. "Yes," she said, "fine." She reminded me that her filmmaker friend had taken her to a screening of the new movie with Olivia Colman, The Lost Daughter. The Ferrante thing. Sat at the opposite edge of the bed, she stared into the night. Then, abruptly breaking the shared, dense quiet, she said, "Yeah, I think I need to read that book." 2 days later, she was pressing that book into my hands. "You need to read this," she said. "You're writing about anger. You can't not read it." Of course I'd read it, I thought to myself, grateful for this live interest in my mind and projects. Besides, it was invitingly slim, nothing like the forbiddingly thick Neapolitan novels everyone went on about. And it was Friday, so I could read as late as I liked. Still, as I turned to the first page, I was aware of some slight disturbance at the periphery, some sense of being not quite sure what kind of gift this was. "You need to read this." But why, and what would happen if I didn't? The question became more real as the novel sucked me into its vortex of female and maternal anger, with Leda, its narrator, screaming with rage, like my mother, because of the crushing weight of responsibility, the bond that strangles. Until "You need to read this" began to feel like an inextricable dimension of the book itself, another front in its violent ambush on my nerves. When I finished the book the next morning, my mind was bubbling with anxious questions. What did you need me to read? Did you mean the fearless anatomy of female discontent that would nourish the book I was writing on anger? Or did you want me, finally, after 22 years raising 3 boys, to hear you screaming with rage at them, at the world, but mostly at me? Do you get it? Do you get it now? Time flies when you're having fun. A watched pot never boils. Folk psychology reminds us that all moods have their own peculiar temporality. Joy seems to vaporize the passing hours, while boredom sadistically elongates the seconds. For its part, anger wrenches us out of the continuum of time, cancelling out both past and future and locking us into the suffocating cell or red mist of the present moment. In an instant, we wipe out any history, friendly, loving or indifferent, with the object of our rage, and burn all bridges to any relationship to come. This helps explain why anger can be so corrosive to long-term relationships. As the consulting room has often shown me, rage has a way of wearing away a marriage's durability, that sense of a containing structure persisting above and beyond the vicissitudes of one or the other's passing feelings. When it runs sufficiently long and deep, anger attacks our emotional hold on what a loved one has been and can be for us, reducing them to the hostile or hateful object of the immediate present. Perhaps the most extreme instance of this tendency can be found in the narrative that frames 1001 Nights, the tale of the Sasanian king Shahryar and his bride Scheherazade. As the story has it, having earlier discovered the faithlessness of one of his wives, the king has her executed. Believing all women to be the same at heart, he marries a succession of virgins, each of whom he puts to death the following morning before she too can dishonour him. Shahryar's royally licensed serial killing issues from a narcissistic wound which each marriage threatens to reopen and which each execution sews up a little more tightly. He is executing not merely the brides, but the possibility of passing time, of a future whose emotional risks he cannot predict. Murdering his brides protects him from the pain of what hasn't yet happened, but at the hellish price of sealing himself inside the same obsessively repeated act of violent rage. When the vizier's daughter Scheherazade hears of the king's murderous campaign against the adulterers of the future, she boldly offers herself up as the king's next bride. On their wedding night, she entertains Shahryar with a tale only to suspend its climax, compelling him to postpone her execution if he wishes to hear its end. Once she has brought it to a close, she begins another, only once again to hold off concluding it. The postponement of the execution is repeated over the next 1,000 nights, during which time she has borne the king 3 sons. By the time Scheherazade tells the king she's finally run out of stories, he is too much in love with her to go through with the endlessly postponed execution, and so makes her his queen instead. While told by a single character, the stories in 1001 Nights were collected over centuries across different regions of Asia and Africa and compiled in Arabic by Islamic scholars. Many are iterations of tales that go back to the very earliest civilizations and have been translated into new languages and cultures. Scheherazade, in other words, releases her bridegroom from the grip of his rageful Groundhog Day by inducing him to hear other, unknown voices, stories, and worlds. It may not be merely narrative suspense that ensures her survival, but the space and time she creates to make these unknown people and landscapes sensible to the king, pulling him out of his claustrophobic certainty and into new regions of strangeness and curiosity. As an association to my wife's one-off gift, Scheherazade's tales may appear both wildly overblown and off the mark, not least because Ferrante's novel seems to be signalling my wife's rage more than postponing mine. But I stand by its salience here. For Ferrante, Scheherazade and my wife address anger, whether their own or their partner's, in the indirect form of someone else's story. Stories, after all, unfold in language and narrative, which is to say, over time. If they express rage, they do so not in concentrated explosions of accusation and insult, but in the intricately crafted creations of other voices, of characters and situations that we have to get to know. In handing me the lost daughter, wasn't my wife at once communicating and displacing intimate personal truths about her experience of marriage and motherhood, sending a message from and about both herself and someone else too, and about both me and someone else? Anyone who has been in or even around a long-term couple will be aware that marital rows are most destructive when their salvos are delivered in tones of self-certainty, or what I earlier called the knowledge of being right. If it didn't sound like an unintentionally hilarious parody of middle-class domesticity, I might propose that instead of trading wounding barbs, couples exchange novels. Less concretely, I would suggest that lurking inside Scheherazade's storytelling ruse is the key to the problem of how to live with our anger. If anger is to serve as more than the emotional prelude to aggressive action, executing one's wives, say, or political opponents, or deporting refugees, or denying elections, then it must be disarmed of the self-certainty that propels it. The affliction of the rageful person is that they are deprived of all voices but their own, which drowns out and excludes all others from the mind's ear. We need to find ways to make those voices audible and to carve out the time and space to listen to them. This fine-sounding proposition becomes questionable the moment we ask how we go about achieving this goal. If drowning out the other's voice is the essential logic of anger, it may not make much sense simply to propose we stop doing it. A recent Guardian article compiled a helpful list of techniques for managing anger, among them the time-honored hacks of counting to 3, punching a pillow, and walking in nature. Some techniques involve a temporary suspension of our anger, some a hydraulic discharge of it, others still a complete diversion away from it. But not even the most enthusiastic booster for these techniques is going to claim they can actually dispel anger. At best, they can insert a pause, slow its momentum, perhaps bring some passing relief from the pressure it exerts on us. Since there is no reliable method, psychoanalysis not excluded, for dispelling anger, only different ways of living with it, why should we object to hacks? If counting or yelling or breathing can shield us from the most reckless and destructive consequences of our rage, it would be hubris to disparage or dismiss them. If there's a problem with such practical psychology, it arises not in its individual uses, but in the internal relationship it sets up between ourselves and our angry feelings. Behavioural solutions, because their aim is to make us feel less angry, put us at odds with our anger, make an enemy of it. Put a brake on it, or expel it, or try to forget it, they exhort us, but at any rate, break off contact with it. Scheherazade uses allied techniques, delaying and diverting her husband's anger until it finally exhausts itself. But what she doesn't do is try to coax him out of his anger. On the contrary, as dawn arrives each morning, she presents him with a choice which demands he listen to his own state of feeling. Discharge your anger against women and put me to death, or spare me another day so you can hear the end of my story. At each of these moments, Shahryar is forced to measure his anger against his desire by listening to both, to ask himself whether his accumulated rage against women trumps his curiosity and excitement. We can cast a little light on the nature of this dilemma by turning to the Italian psychoanalyst Eugenio Gaddini, whose paper of 1972, Aggression and the Pleasure Principle, develops a psychoanalytic theory of aggression. This involves distinguishing between two different kinds of human energy. The first, which he calls aggressive energy, is linked to the concept of action. It serves the biological aim of achieving homeostasis, or the lowest and most even possible distribution of stimulus around the organism, by means of an external discharge of energy through the motor apparatus. The model for this discharge is set up at the beginning of life, namely the baby's muscular sucking apparatus, which serves as the first and complete model of coordinated action. In sucking at the mother's breast or a bottle, the baby is discharging through the muscles around his mouth and jaw the tension accumulated by his rising hunger. Directing his bodily motor apparatus, the limbs and organs and muscles that work in concert to satisfy our bodily demands, to serve his nutritional needs, he is mounting his first aggressive action in the external world. Aggressive energy is primarily directed towards meeting vital needs in the name of survival. In this sense, its quality is essentially impersonal, oriented towards one's development not as an individual, but as a member of the species. Put more crudely, it is more concerned with what I need than with what I want. This is in direct contrast to Gaddini's second kind of energy, much more familiar in the context of psychoanalysis, libidinal energy. If aggressive energy tends outwards towards action, libidinal energy tends inwards towards affect or feeling. It is the medium of desire, of the conduct of the individual rather than the member of a species. Feelings, as the word hints, disturb our internal equilibrium, arousing us to passions we may be unable to understand or to bring under our control. Our individuality is defined in and through our feelings. Without feelings, we are interchangeably functional units, permanently stuck in the loop of our own blind survival. Aggression, we might say, anonymizes me, where libido personalizes me. For aggressive energy, discharge is imperative and the baby can't tolerate its postponement for long. The longer he remains unfed, for example, the more liable he is to become psychically as well as somatically dysregulated. Libidinal tension, on the other hand, is generally easier to bear. Indeed, children and adults alike know that the gratifications of pleasure, gustatory, sexual or otherwise, can often be enhanced by being postponed. As Gaddini has it, libidinal tension is less rigid and more plastic, and inasmuch as it is a source of pleasure, it can be prolonged. We can see the tension between these two kinds of energy at work in the Scheherazade story. Shahryar's serial execution of his brides is a bid to kill off the possibility of homeostatic disturbance, in this case the humiliation of an unfaithful wife, before it can even arise. It has the urgency and impersonality of blind action taken in the name of survival. Shahryar won't literally die if his bride lives, of course, but the possibility of her betrayal is felt by him as an intolerable threat to his basic sense of personal integrity and cohesion. The impersonality Gaddini ascribes to aggressive energy operates here at its furthest extreme. How true, loving, and desirable an individual bride may be doesn't matter to Sharia. Each one exists only as an abstract representative of the hated category of woman, and it is as such, rather than as a singular person, that he executes her. There is also, to be sure, an element of libidinal energy at work in his murderousness, for the threat he feels from female sexuality hints at quantities of anger and desire in him that he cannot keep under control. But this libidinal charge is enlisted in the service of his aggressive bid for mastery over the other. Ensnaring her husband in the web of her stories, Scheherazade rebalances the distributions of aggressive and libidinal energy. As long as he's dominated by aggression, Sharia cannot allow action to be postponed. He must kill the next bride before she can expose him to any further humiliation. But under the spell cast by Scheherazade, he can begin to bear the more plastic tension of libido to live more for desire than for survival. Scheherazade's position in the network of royal power and prerogative doesn't allow her to express anger. We see only her charm, wit, and deference. Those attitudes and traits she is licensed to display in the royal court. But it isn't hard to imagine her storytelling scheme being tacitly informed by a kind of angry urgency to stop the flow of femicides and bring to heel the unrelenting violence of her husband's will. To the rigid, unyielding, aggressive energy of Sharia, she opposes an adaptive and flexible libidinal energy. An excess of aggressive energy tends to foster the illusion that I am, to use Winnicott's term, an isolate, an integral being sealed off from all other beings with whom I must compete for life's necessities. Libidinal energy signals, on the contrary, that my existence is inextricably bound up with and dependent on others. It is much easier to cut yourself off from feelings about others if you can convince yourself you don't depend on others. This dependency, as Sharia so starkly reminds us, is apt to make us feel very angry and humiliated, even to the point that, rather than bear these feelings, we might prefer to kill the person who arouses them. Every patient I've seen leaves an indelible sensory impression, some quality of their voice or walk or dress or smile. When I recall Stella's face, delicate, oval and pale, it is caught forever in mid-eye roll, as though there could be no escape, even for a moment, from life's crushing irony. So defining was the gesture, it seemed to spread from her face into the insouciant rhythms of her speech and movement, as though one could eye-roll with one's whole body. Literary theorists note that irony, saying something other than what we mean, can be used both to unsettle meaning and to fix it in place. Stella's irony was very much of the latter variety. Whatever she might say, I was rarely left in doubt as to how she really felt. The fluency of her speech never wavered, nor the soft and even pitch of her voice, nor the easy grace with which her open hand sliced the air as she spoke. Yet she made no pretense of concealing the sheer rage lurking beneath her languid elegance. I had first seen her in March, when she told me her marriage was becoming intolerable. When I asked her why, she told me it was because Max, her husband of 9 years, was irredeemably useless as a husband, father, and lover for all his talent as a consultant cardiologist. "He knows all about hearts," she said, her voice lilting gently upwards as she arched her eyebrow, and added, "with a mysterious exception of mine." From our first meeting, I was aware and wary of the temptation to be recruited to her psychic team, to enjoy too readily the gleeful precision with which she dispatched her targets. Most people come to me for the first time in a state of palpable anxiety and confusion, unable to make sense of what they are feeling or why. Stella seemed peculiarly clear on both counts. She was feeling the exasperation and despair of being married to a man of acutely low emotional intelligence. Those early sessions quickly became exercises in remote evisceration, brutal yet forensically precise dissections of Max's manifold incompetences. He would put their little girl's skirt on her back to front, or drone tediously at dinner parties about the latest advances in coronary medicine. He could go a week without asking a single question about herself or her life, but come the weekend, he could be relied upon to signal sexual desire by way of this ludicrous grin, which he seems to delude himself is a seductive smile, asking me if I know you fancy a bit of fun upstairs. Like what, Max? I feel like replying. Chasing diazepam with a bottle of vodka? At the edges of these performative assassinations, I could feel a hint of seduction, as though relaying these shaming details of Max's inadequacies were a way of marking me off from him, placing me as the adult man to his outsized boy, and letting me know she was sure I knew how to soothe a crying child, load a dishwasher, or locate a clitoris. I would dutifully remind myself I was the object of an idealizing transference, that such ostentatious love was only ever the obverse of an unconscious hate. But perhaps I was only paying lip service to these cautions, unconsciously setting them aside so I could continue to enjoy the dubious narcissistic pleasure of triumphing over a phantom husband. A few weeks later, Stella returned to the first session after Easter break, noticeably pale and downcast. She lay still for a couple of minutes before flatly announcing, "He's left me." "He's left you," I said. "That's what I said, wasn't it?" she replied. "He's left me." I remained silent, too disorientated to speak. "Well, I'll say one thing for him. He surprised me, and you too, by the sounds of it." I said nothing. "Nope, didn't see that one coming," she continued. "But then neither did you, and you're the shrink. Can't help thinking there was a big miss somewhere along the line." Then for the first time, a furious break in a breezily ironic tone. "Yeah, a big, expensive fucking miss. Prof, you're the psychoanalyst. Why didn't you say something?" The Greek word anagnorisis describes the point in a story when a key character makes a discovery that casts his previous experience in a new and transformative light. The most famous example is also a locus classicus for psychoanalysis, the discovery by Oedipus that he's murdered his father and married his mother. The word came to me unbidden in that moment, alongside the startling realization that I hadn't said something for all that time because, while I'd been listening, I'd not picked up what I needed to hear, namely that when she had talked about her useless husband, she'd been talking about me. Every analyst in every analysis draws a transference to themselves. I had lulled myself into believing that I stood for some version of her father, a successful and dominant man who treated her mother with the same reflexive impatience Stella showed towards her husband. I hadn't wanted to notice that the man she'd been talking about and eye-rolling all those weeks, the man who knew neither how to listen nor how to communicate, who might have a good enough reputation but was clearly no use to her, this man, whatever name she may have called him, was me. Perhaps this interpretation sounds like too wild a stretch, an instance of the psychoanalyst's annoying habit of making everything about themselves. Only when I put it to Stella, she paused and seemed to recover her seamless composure. She said. "Yes, that sounds about right." She paused again. "Even a stop clock, blah, blah, blah." This first stage of work with Stella serves as a cogent reminder that psychoanalysis is a way of thinking about the strange knots of time. One of Freud's most enigmatic and productive concepts, developed especially in his 1918 Wolfman case, is Nachträglichkeit, literally afterwardsness. The rendering of the term by James Strachey, Freud's English translator, as deferred action is misleading, connoting as it does the idea of an event or experience whose meaning is deferred, that is, which can only be understood at a later date. This isn't exactly wrong, but it's unhelpfully linear, as though it were simply a matter of waiting for the real meaning of the earlier event to come into focus later. French psychoanalysis in the mid-20th century, under the influence of Jacques Lacan in particular, proved more adept at coaxing out the deeper and more unsettling sense of Freud's term, coining the rendition now widely used even in Anglophone psychoanalysis, après coup. Après coup, literally after blow, captures the essential non-linearity of psychoanalytic time. Retrospection doesn't simply clarify or explain earlier events in our lives, throwing time out of joint. It can bring those events into being, as though the later experience preceded the earlier one. When Oedipus discovers the truth of his origins, he doesn't merely learn something new about his past. He undergoes a kind of shattering transformation of his whole life and self. In an experiential sense, we could say Oedipus commits patricide and maternal incest decades after he kills his father and beds his mother. In fact, tragedy is almost always shaped by an après-coup logic, for the simple reason that it portrays human beings in the grip of forces they cannot comprehend in the moment they're at work. And for that reason, when comprehension comes, it always comes too late. As he visits the ultimate retribution on himself for his wife's murder, Othello asks to be remembered as one that loved not wisely, but too well, of one not easily jealous, but being wrought, perplexed in the extreme. Othello's anagnorisis involves not merely the discovery of previously unknown facts, the unaccountably maligned stratagems of Iago, but of unbearable truths about himself. He realizes too late that he was vulnerable to his ensign's manipulation because his passions exceeded him. Loving too well means loving not too generously, but too much, to a point where he is mastered by and not master of his love. Recall Itzig on the wild horse, so often invoked by Freud to figure the ferocious momentum of the drive. "Where are you going?" shout the peasants on the road. "Do I know?" he replies. "Ask the horse." This is Othello's après-coup, the sudden awareness that his passion has ridden him into regions too dark to see where he's gone or what he's done. Iago's diabolical subtlety lies in his intuition of the precise quantum of doubt required to turn Othello's overabundant love to rageful jealousy. We might also say, following Gaddini, that Iago transforms the energy driving Othello's passion. When we meet Othello, he speaks with a rare refinement of feeling and emotional insight of how he and Desdemona fell in love. At her father Brabantio's house, having regaled her with stories of war and savagery, "She loved me for the dangers I had passed, and I loved her that she did pity them." In these lines we hear a voice turned inward, tuned into the life of feeling, attending to the subtleties of emotional exchange. She falls in love listening to him, he falls in love with her listening. This is the delicately personal quality of relating that characterizes libidinal energy. Iago captures that energy and spikes it, injecting a poisonous suspicion into the abundant stream of Othello's love and turning it into an ungovernable excess of blind aggression. He brutally depersonalizes Desdemona for Othello, who comes to see her like one of Shahryar's virgin brides, an interchangeable exemplar of feminine evil fit only to be killed. In the light of the après-coup, ignorance is revealed not as an unfortunate contingency of psychic life, but as its essence. Ironically enough, this ignorance is something of which we prefer to remain ignorant. Confronted with their own vulnerability, Louis Trevelyan, Shahryar and Othello choose the destructive consequences of false certainty rather than to bear the inevitable pain of not knowing. To trust the one you love is indeed a terrible risk. The meaning of trust implies the possibility of its betrayal. Once awakened to this possibility, none of these three men can live with it. They prefer the conviction their lover is false to ignorance of whether she's true, even as this preference consigns them to their own personal hell. For the man caught in this hell of his own making, anger becomes his reliable friend, a comfort blanket swaddled tightly round himself, the assurance, even as he suffers at the extremities of isolation and self-hatred, that he's right. Anger serves as a talisman against doubt, against having to go through life knowing very little, either about ourselves or anyone close to us. For Trevelyan and Othello, the après-coup can only be a disaster, forcing them to reckon with a truth they've spent most of their lives furiously denying. We might say that both die of the après-coup, of the knowledge that clinging to their rightness has cost them their own and another's lives. Rightness runs on aggressive energy. It is defensive, automatic, and will not take the risk of listening to the self or to another, which is to say the risk of being led by desire. This is the chance we take when we let ourselves be guided by the flows of libidinal energy, by the feelings that animate and unsettle body and soul alike. Perhaps it's here that we start to edge towards a sense of what it would be to have a positive and meaningful experience of our own anger. Aggressive anger stakes itself on the premise that if we already know we're right, we never have to get up close to our angry feelings, to listen to what they're saying, to what unknown anxieties and desires might secretly be driving them. How might a more libidinally driven anger be different? To invoke the Itzig analogy, it wouldn't mean allowing the wild horse of rage to hurtle towards blind action, nor would it mean wielding the riding crop of anger management to force the horse to a premature halt. To recall Antonio Damasio, it would involve the experience of feelings rather than mere emotions. Where emotions, in Damasio's sense, are essentially reactive stimulus responses, the realm of aggressive energy, feelings involve the internal mapping of those immediate stimuli, listening to and making sense of what they're telling us, raising our trigger responses to a higher level of consciousness. This isn't to imply that feelings are serene and contemplative, looking down from an Olympian height at our hardwired primitive reactions. The transition into feeling means that emotion finds a footing in ideas and words, a mode of expression beyond reaction. In anger management, the idea is to stop feeling angry. In psychoanalysis, the aim is more to start feeling angry rather than merely being angry. The Hulk, recall, is angry, is anger itself. But this manifestation of anger comes at the explicit price of radical dissociation from the speaking human being in whom he originated. Having lost all contact with words and ideas, the Hulk's only expressive vehicle is violent action. In anger management, he would be enjoined to calm down, as though his anger were a toddler whose waywardness must be brought under control by the finger-wagging parent called reason. Psychoanalysis would instead be interested in bringing the Hulk back into contact with the man from whom he split off, in finding ways for the man whose anger is trapped on the inside and the monster, whose anger is trapped on the outside, to give voice to one another. Simply calming him down and getting him to speak reasonably would ensure that his anger was never heard as anger, as felt experience, but as a temporary bit of madness from which he's now moved on. The difference between suppressing and listening to our anger has significance far beyond the confines of the consulting room and the individual. Its broader implications are made evident in the ways our political masters respond to the anger of its citizens. In 2022, the UK government passed the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Act, PCSCA, which instituted a major expansion of the state's power to regulate protest, giving the police discretion to ban or curtail public protests and to impose massive fines and prison sentences on activists deemed to be obstructing highways or other public areas. The following year saw the passage of the Public Order Act, 2023, which has added to the PCSCA new provisions to expand police stop and search powers for individuals suspected of plans to commit protest-related offences, as well as specifically criminalising locking on and other obstructive tactics used by climate activists to interfere with fossil fuel-based infrastructure and transport systems. Under these provisions, two Just Stop Oil activists, Marcus Decker and Morgan Trowland, received two-year prison sentences for climbing the cables of a suspension bridge in Dartford, where the London Orbital Motorway, M25, crosses the Thames. It's difficult to avoid the suspicion, which its recent abandonments of key environmental commitments on transport, energy and forest protection have only amplified, that the current Conservative government's aim is to silence not merely anger, but the urgency and anxiety that fuels it. Even as it dismantles projects to address the climate emergency and suppresses the voices that call attention to it, it continues its gaslighting insistence that it is meeting its green pledges. The government points to the availability of other avenues of protest, such as petitions and letter writing, forms of representation that corral anger into the narrowest and most innocuous channels, licensing their recipients to pay lip service to them, if not ignore them altogether. In other words, it seeks to create a kind of hostile environment for public anger. This hostility, however, is notably selective. As the government was preparing to pass the Public Order Bill, the former Conservative leader and MP Ian Duncan Smith publicly backed pro-motorist activists who vandalised ultra-low-emission zone ULEZ cameras monitoring polluting car emissions in London. It turns out there is a much more congenial environment for obstructing or destroying infrastructure that challenges fossil fuel interests than for infrastructure that supports them. We saw in the previous chapter that contemporary populism harnesses a diffuse anger that it mobilises for the protection of the existing order and against the threat of any change or disturbance to it. This is the anger generated by aggressive energy, which leaps to action that will buttress power and silence any voices which unsettle or question it. Its primary enemy is libidinal energy, which is concerned not with maintaining homeostatic comfort, but with asking what it is that we desire, individually and collectively. From the perspective of power, the problem with desire is that it might induce us to refuse what's on offer and demand something new. Psychoanalysis differentiates itself from behavioural therapies, above all, in listening for the unpredictable flows of libidinal energy, even if this means putting in question ourselves and our lives. In this sense, it has an essential affinity with art, with which it shares a capacity to unsettle our assumptions about who we are and what we want. When my wife handed me The Lost Daughter with that peculiar urgency, she was letting me know that this was one of those works of art that intrude into the most private and vulnerable spaces of a person's interior and lodges there. She was signalling a kind of disturbance at the border between fiction and reality, a sense that this novel might be carrying truths too violent for reality to bear, things unsayable in the medium of ordinary conversation, even the most intimate. Sometimes the strangest and most difficult feelings can be made audible to ourselves and each other only through the detours and displacements of fiction. Or, in Ferrante's case, potboilers, dizzyingly paced sagas rich in conflict, crisis, scandal, carnality, in all the narrative pleasures and enervations of low cultural forms, teen photo romances, women's magazines, soap operas she avowedly draws on. But in borrowing from these subgenres, she divines in them concealed horrors they themselves can never disclose, and stretches them to excess, threatening their structure and coherence. The spark that lights the touch paper of Ferrante's stories is typically a breakdown, which becomes not only the motor of the narrator's plot, but the event that induces her to write in the first place. Namely, the novels portray events whose force and meaning can't be contained in the minds of those to whom they happen. This is where they exceed soap opera. The disaster they dramatise is less the objective experience of loss, betrayal, abandonment or violence than the shattering of any means of representing it, the unravelling of any story that could tell it. Leda, for example, the narrator and protagonist of The Lost Daughter, connects Nani, the doll she has stolen from a lost girl, to her second pregnancy. In her own mind, Leda's first pregnancy was a period of intense pleasure, a transcendent experience of carrying a life purified of humours and blood, humanised, intellectualised, with nothing that could evoke the blind cruelty of live matter as it expands. The doll reminds her that her second pregnancy was very far from this airy, near-disembodied experience. As she empties from the depths of its inert body a viscous stream of grainy brown liquid, she recalls carrying the fetus that would become her daughter, Marta. "She attacked my body, forcing it to turn on itself, out of control. She immediately manifested herself not as Marta, but as a piece of living iron in my stomach. My body became a bloody liquid. Suspended in it was a mushy sediment inside which grew a violent polyp. so far from anything human that it reduced me, even though it fed and grew, to rotting matter without life. Nani, with her black spittle, resembles me when I was pregnant for the second time. Living iron, bloody liquid, mushy sediment, violent polyp, rotting matter, black spittle. The pile-up of imagery is a delirious mimesis of the body's and the novel's out-of-control attack on itself. The controlled beauty of the humanized, intellectualized novel sinks sickeningly into a formless, overlapping mass of bodily symptoms and redundant synonyms. "The real breakdown for me," Lader comments, "was that the giving up of any sublimation of my pregnancy, not the pregnancy itself, but her inability to give it creative or intellectual form. This is the misfortune afflicting Lader." The passage places us in the region Ferrante calls frantumaglia, a Neapolitan dialect word meaning jumble of fragments. For Ferrante, this is the sudden and incomprehensible revelation of the self to itself as an infinite serial or aquatic mass of debris, a pure disorder or incoherence lurking just under the surface of the discrete, integral I we present to the world. It is also the state of psychic and linguistic chaos lurking just under and forever threatening to break through the precise and efficient surface of Ferrante's prose. My wife gave me The Lost Daughter as a husband and father, as a writer, but also, and again, ambiguously, as a psychoanalyst. Ambiguously because she was fully aware of passing on a book that seems to affirm some of the most basic psychoanalytic insights about maternal ambivalence, but also a book that ought to make a man, even and especially a male psychoanalyst, wary of understanding it too quickly. You, husband and father and analyst, need to read this because your life at home and your training and your daily work may lead you to think you know something about what motherhood does to a woman, which may even be right, but which is also fatally wrong, wrong in a way that this book makes fully apparent. In fact, this is just where Ferrante locates her suspicions about psychoanalysis, that is, in its tendency to organize into universal representations what in the individual, beyond any system, beyond any analysis, remains pure, specific inner disorder, irreducible flashes of ectoplasm, a jumble of fragments without any chronology. Put more simply, what troubles Ferrante above all about psychoanalysis is its orientation towards understanding, which often enough tends also to be the orientation of husbands and fathers and analysts towards mothers. Ferrante loves Freud, she says, because he perceived more perspicuously than his followers that psychoanalysis is the lexicon of the precipice. Its concepts are too dangerous, too resistant to our efforts to know and understand, to be assimilated to expert knowledge. It's not surprising, then, that in another interview from 2015 for the Paris Review, Ferrante remarks that she has, from the beginning, produced a writing that is dissatisfied with itself. Her narrators and the stories they tell are driven by a dissatisfaction that is only exacerbated by all their restless and ultimately vain attempts to resolve it. Dissatisfaction is the motor of her writing, and its expressive medium is rage. Each of her protagonists is afflicted at the outset by some wound, a humiliation or betrayal to which they will not reconcile themselves, which they insist on protesting, resisting, lamenting, thus consigning themselves to an anger even deeper and more irremediable. The Neapolitan Quartet begins with the narrator Lenu's rage at her best friend Leela's decision, at the age of 26, to withdraw herself wholesale from the world and eliminate the entire life she had left behind. In her most recent novel, The Lying Life of Adults, the narrator's aunt Vittoria is a teeming volcano, permanently enraged at her brother for having broken up her affair with a married man. And in Ferrante's second novel, The Days of Abandonment, Olga, the protagonist and narrator, becomes an increasingly angry polemicist against explanation, specifically the trite rationalizations offered to her when her husband Mario leaves her for another, much younger woman. Mario's colleague tells her, "It's that age. Mario is 40. It happens." Olga finds it particularly unbearable to be told Mario is simply conforming to expected behavioural patterns, as though merely knowing this should salve the gaping wound of her abandonment and humiliation. But the expectation of resigned equanimity is all around her, not least in herself. The reasonableness of others and my own desire for tranquillity got on my nerves. Despite her anger, Olga imposes a code of good behaviour on herself. She will not intrude on Mario's friends. She will not be hateful. A code that derives from the long-standing and deeply internalized imperative to conceal the clamorous life within. Over the years, she has taught herself to speak in gentle tones, to subordinate all instinctual reactions to thoughtful delay, to wait patiently until every emotion imploded and could come out in a tone of calm, my voice held back in my throat so that I would not make a spectacle of myself. Described thus, this struggle between impulses to express and to withhold emotion starts to look more complicated than a straightforward conflict between instinctual violence and civilized self-control. Freud, after all, reminds us that repression draws its energy from the forces of lust and rage it wants to repress, employing their violence against them. To tell someone, yourself or another, in the grip of rage to stay calm, that these things happen, that you'll get over it, is as likely to be felt as an attack as a reassurance, a denial of what you're feeling and a demand to feel otherwise. Read in this light, Ferrante's entire corpus starts to reverberate with the same conflict between two kinds of anger. The first is the rage of the afflicted, the neglected, the betrayed, of the pent-up accumulations of dissatisfaction and demand we hear in the voices of troubling loves Delia, in Leda, Olga, Lenu, Leela, and in the lying life of adults Vittoria, as well as in the protests of exploited factory workers, whose voices intrude into the febrile chorus of everyday life in the Neapolitan quartet. This rage, searching, vulnerable, uncertain of what it wants, aligns with the libidinally driven anger I've described above. Set alongside it, the second kind of anger is rooted in fear of this first kind. It is the rage of men against women, rich against poor, fascists and Camorrists against ordinary citizens, mothers against daughters. And it's the rage of individuals, especially women, against themselves. Who was Stella raging against? Against her husband, certainly, at times her mother, and eventually, as we've seen, against me. For weeks, she sustained a cold fury towards me for my failure to call out her unrelenting criticism and denigration of her husband. Wasn't it obvious that he wasn't going to put up with it indefinitely, that at some point his rope would fray irreparably? "I'm aware," she said, "of your professional duty to remain neutral, refrain from directing me and all of that, but I was telling you daily that I made him feel useless and unwanted, and you just sat there like you were witnessing a car barrel full speed into some poor oblivious pedestrian without so much as a warning shout." Who was she in this analogy, I asked her, the car driver or the pedestrian? "What?" she replied, raising her voice. "This is the problem. I tell you something urgent and you give back pedantry. Who was I? I don't know. The driver, I suppose. God knows that's what Max would have said." "I'm not sure the question is pedantic. I think your analogy is more telling than you realise. It was you I didn't shout a warning to. That surely makes you the poor oblivious pedestrian." "Fine," she said irritably, and then paused. "So who's the driver then? I'm not aware of anyone having rammed me with a car, real or figurative. Except perhaps for you." The impact felt palpable in the silence that followed, as though she had indeed been hit by a figurative car. For perhaps the first time since we'd started, I felt like I had some sense of where her mind was. I said we both seemed to be contemplating a scene of helplessness in the face of a disaster, a driver who can't stop the car, a pedestrian who can't see it coming, a witness who can't shout a warning. In a tone of deep sadness and quiet, she said, "You're describing my life." When I'd been hit by the après-coup realization that the useless man she'd been railing against was me, a question had continued to trouble me. Why had she needed me to warn her? Wasn't it obvious to her what she was doing? The analogy with the imminent accident gave me a kind of answer. The scene cast her as driver, pedestrian, and witness, watching herself fall under her own speeding car and unable to run out of the way, hit the brake, or shout a warning. Her complaint now was that she had needed me to be the witness she couldn't be to herself, to shout loud enough to startle her out of her self-destructive rage. Psychoanalysis frequently reproduces, or to use the technical term, enacts the scenarios the patient creates outside the consulting room. This is what had happened here. Stella rendered me, the person she most needed to help her, helpless. Although, to put it this way gives the misleading impression that I was her victim, it would be more accurate to say that I was complicit with her, that, like so many of the people around her, I fell in with the idea that she was the safe and confident driver of her own life. I didn't let it occur to me that she was unable to get out of the way of her own car, that even as she could see she was heading for the collision, she couldn't tell herself to stop. Yes, the useless person concealed by Max was me, but the useless person concealed by me and the ultimate object of her rage was Stella herself. Here, the word useless takes on a poignant resonance. In his seminal paper of 1969, The Use of an Object, D.W. Winnicott suggests that in earliest life, a child needs to develop the capacity to use others. Using another person has an overwhelmingly negative connotation for us, connoting an instrumental, if not cynical, way of relating to them. Winnicott's point is that we're able to use someone only when we recognize that we need them. That is, when we see in them something they can offer and that we don't already have. This requires us to perceive the other as separate from us rather than, as Winnicott has it, a bundle of projections. When the other is a mere bundle of our projections, we reduce them to versions of ourselves. Instead of being seen for who they are, they become embodiments of our own anxieties, beliefs, and desires. This was Stella's predicament, the source of her malaise. Everyone she cared about, sooner or later, became a bundle of her projections, an iteration of the inadequate, disappointing self she saw in the mirror. Her husband was indeed useless, but only because she lacked the means to use him. What might happen in early life to prevent us from developing this capacity? A child can only learn to use an adult who can let themselves be used. Behind her soft and affectionate persona, Stella's mother had concealed a profound depression. A year after she had first come to see me, Stella began to talk to her mother about her early years. Her mother, reluctant at first to rake over the past, seemed to feel some relief in talking about a period experienced in such lonely isolation. Stella's mother had given up her work as a GP to raise Stella and the sister that came after her. Stella's father ran a successful medical publishing company that frequently kept him at the office into the evenings. Having assumed she would take to child-rearing with ease and pleasure, her mother was in some shock, as well as feeling overwhelmingly guilty, at the sheer boredom and nervous exhaustion motherhood induced in her. Her husband would only exacerbate his wife's sense of inadequacy and self-hatred, telling her that her negative feelings weren't natural, that she had nothing to complain about. She should try doing his job for a few days. That'd give her a reason to grumble. "I was wary of her," Stella told me. "I can't remember her ever having shouted at me and only a few explicitly cross words. But from the youngest age, I was aware of how close she seemed to unravelling, forever asking us with that pitiful, imploring look to stop running, laughing, arguing, forever at the edge of migraine or swallowing the lump in her throat." Stella found herself perpetually tiptoeing around her mother, all the while quietly accumulating and suppressing her own resentments and tensions. It wasn't difficult to see the traces of this history in Stella's adult personality. Her brutally high-handed irony was rooted in a repudiation of her mother's neediness and sensitivity, ensuring that everyone around her was useless, meaning they could never make her feel dependent on them. She cultivated an aggressive rage that helped shore up her invulnerability and confirm no one could give her anything, love, interest, pleasure, care, she really needed. She had married out of an unconscious wish to prove she had no need of a husband, and entered psychoanalysis from an unconscious wish to prove she had no need of an analyst. If she now wanted her husband back and needed an analyst to understand herself, Then who was she? She had wanted to believe she was her father's daughter, emotionally self-sufficient and in command of the world around her, only to find herself living the lonely and precarious inner life of her mother. How was she to discover an anger she could use? The maternal relationship is the primary source of rage for Ferrante's characters. Most of her narrator protagonists are both mothers and daughters, caught in a pincer movement of the generations above and below. Leda recalls her mother dragging her from the sea, trembling with cold. "When she saw that my teeth were chattering, she became even more furious, yanked me, covered me from head to toe in a towel, rubbed me with such an energy, such violence, that I didn't really know if it was a worry for my health or long-fostered rage, a ferocity that chafed my skin." Rage blurs the boundaries between love and hate. The unbearable burden of love that stirs Leda's mother to such alarm is felt as a ferocious resentment and a wish rubbed violently into her daughter's skin to be free of its overbearing demands. In becoming a mother herself, Leda will fall into the same trap. Recalling a day when her daughter got lost on the beach, she takes up the perspective of a frightened child with rare empathetic insight. A child who gets lost on the beach sees everything unchanged and yet no longer recognizes anything. But when Leda finally finds her, the empathy instantly gives way to rage as she screams at her daughter, "With rage, like my mother, because of the crushing weight of responsibility, the bond that strangles, and with my free arm I dragged my firstborn, yelling, 'You'll pay for this, Bianca, you'll see when we get home.'" Leda is still the little girl reeling under the blows of her mother's raging love, even as she becomes the mother, dispossessed by the incomprehensible intensity of her own rage. What becomes insupportable in that moment is the sense of loss and abandonment conveyed by Bianca's tears, inducing in Leda a pain so excruciatingly close to her own childhood experience, she can only drown it out in furious threats. For Ferrante, a mother can never avoid transmitting to her child the same state of unconscious self-division inherited from her own mother. The mother's wish to redeem the privations and cruelties of her own childhood comes into tension with a resentment towards the daughter enjoying the freedoms and possibilities she lacked. In Those Who Leave and Those Who Stay, Lenu's mother, Immacolata, deprived from childhood of any educational or commercial exit paths out of poverty, menaces her daughter, now a published novelist and fiancée to a distinguished young professor, with the injunction not to forget that "I who carried you in here am just as intelligent, if not more, and if I had had the chance, I would have done the same as you, understand?" Immacolata fights her own desire to realize through her child the future denied herself, the wish described by Freud in his essay on narcissism to fulfill those wishful dreams of the parents which they never carried out. In The Story of the Lost Child, the last of the quartet, Immacolata from her sickbed speaks to Lenu of her life as an unending series of dissatisfactions. Marriage to a man she can't recall ever having given her pleasure, a lack of feeling for the children she bore after Lenu, a sin for which she would now go to hell, and finally the disappointment of Lenu herself, now the scandalous woman who has left her respectable husband for a pathological philanderer. For Immacolata, Lenu is her eldest and only true child, the moment of her birth, the only good thing in my life, which only makes her refusal of Immacolata's narcissistic projections all the more unforgivable. Lenu, for her part, is caught in a peculiar bind. Without the self-assertive anger that has enabled her to escape the confines of the neighbourhood, she could not have fulfilled her mother's deepest wish, namely, that she live a different and better life. But the same anger has led to an irremediable separation that her mother has felt as violently hostile. Immacolata carries an anger sufficiently fierce to disrupt the existing order, but which has been diverted into shoring it up. Thus does libidinal anger become aggressive. This conflict between a disruptive libidinal anger and a reactive aggressive anger haunts Ferrante's novels, frequently manifesting in conflagrations, marital breakdowns, generational clashes, labour disputes that leave behind only a patch of scorched earth. But there are also sporadic hints of an anger that can be channeled and employed creatively. Indeed, the explicit impetus for Lenu to write Leela's and her own story is the rage she feels when Leela disappears and erases from the world all traces of herself. Instead of cancelling itself out, Lenu's rage finds a home in writing. The quartet explores the ways anger can be marshalled as a source of creative energy. The most memorable instance might be an incident in the second volume, The Story of a New Name, in which Leela, now unhappily married to local entrepreneur and camerist Stefano Caracci, strikes out at her abusive husband by creating a work of art. Leela takes an old advertisement featuring her photo, resplendent in her wedding dress and shoes, and subjects it to artful deformation. With glue, scissors, paper and paint, the materials of the children's art room, Leela's destructive rage channels and transforms itself through play. Using pinned strips of black paper, she erases herself from the image, leaving only bodily traces, an eye, a mouth, a strip of bust, a line of leg, the shoes. The effect is conveyed through the impression of a dramatic change in Leela's mood. As Lenu writes, "Leela was happy, and she was drawing me deeper and deeper into her fierce happiness, because she has suddenly found, perhaps without even realizing it, an opportunity to portray the fury she directed against herself, the insurgence, perhaps for the first time in her life, of the need to erase herself." In this moment, creative and destructive expressions of anger meet each other not in a mutually annihilating fight to the death, but in a paradoxical and productive collusion. Leela erases herself, but this erasure becomes a portrait, a way of giving body to her wish to disappear. The story of the defaced photograph, like the quartet, like all of Ferrante's writing, reminds us why anger needs art. In art, anger finds a home for itself, a mutual accommodation in which the house isn't burnt down and the fire isn't extinguished. Perhaps this is what makes the gift of a book such an effective way to convey a secret rage. Pressed into the receiver's hands, it transmits to them a ferocious heat that somehow miraculously doesn't burn them. Sarcasm, exasperation, contempt, ways of expressing anger that defend against really feeling anger, which was surely why Stella made such liberal use of them. The contemptuous person places herself above the object of her contempt, but equally above herself. She makes a show of her low opinion of the other, but betrays nothing of how hurt or vulnerable she may feel before them or her need for their love and care. The need disgusts her, for it makes her feel as weak and useless as the person she disparages. Within a couple of weeks of his leaving her, Stella discovered Max had been having an affair with a junior doctor in his department. In the previous few sessions, I'd sensed with some hopefulness the quality of perfect, high-handed superiority she always conveyed, giving way to a more ordinary, emotionally layered anger infused with sadness, perhaps even a hint of regret. Anger becomes less rigidly defensive at the point it makes contact with neighbouring emotions like sadness and anxiety. As Gaddini implies, this is where it shifts from expressing itself in the impersonal form of aggression to its more libidinal manifestation of felt inner life. Simply put, it is the difference between insulting the other person and telling them honestly why you feel hurt and angered by them. Stella seemed to be leaning into her feelings of hurt and loss in the days following Max's abrupt departure. She was under no illusion as to how much cause she'd given Max to leave, only in shock at his finding the will to do so. "I suppose I thought he'd resigned himself to being a punching bag, and being who he is, he never caught on that I secretly wanted him to stand up to me. Now he's run away instead." But once she discovered the affair, her contempt went into overdrive. "I gather she's about 28, she said. "What a pathetically sad cliché. High-flying middle-aged consultant taking up with simpering little Miss Junior." She switched into a breathy, high-pitched comedy voice. "Oh, Mr. Max, can I please sit in an ostenting consultation?" And then back to herself. "It'd be funny if it weren't so crushingly sad." And then addressing me, "I expect any man would leave his family for a decent blowjob on a tighter cunt. How about you, prof? Surely even you couldn't resist a pretty young girl on her knees." At first, it all sounded like a reversion to a reassuringly familiar register. but it was impossible not to catch under the surface of her unforgiving mockery the rage and pain of abandonment, of an entire intricate system of defence breaking down inexorably. Recalling the tremor of barely controlled ferocity in her voice, it is hard not to think of Ferrante's Olga in the days of abandonment, catching sight of her husband Mario strolling the streets with his young lover Carla, her ears bearing family heirloom earrings that had once belonged to Olga. After ramming Mario's face into a glass window, throwing him to the floor and kicking him, she makes to rip the earrings from Carla's lobes and tear the flesh. So she thought she had full rights to take my place, to play my part, the fucking whore. Give me those earrings, give me those earrings. I wanted to drag along her beautiful face with the eyes, the nose, the lips, the scalp, the blonde hair. I wanted to drag them with me, as if with a hook I'd snagged her garment of flesh, the sack of her breasts, the belly that wrapped the bowels, and spilled out through the arsehole, through the deep crack crowned with gold. I would hear similarly violent urges towards Max's young lover from Stella, albeit not graduating to actual physical attack. But for a few days at least, it felt like that same level of aggressive rage was seething in her, lacking any outlet beyond her sessions. I let her rant, uninterrupted, discharge her fury in an avalanche of increasingly unbound hate, replete with hair-raising Ferrantian imagery. What did that cunning little bitch want with a sad old pot-bellied pig like Max? But of course she was probably slipping his credit card out of his inside pocket while her other hand played the decoy down his pants. What a colossally deluded, narcissistic prick he was, believing her interest could have any other motive. Those sessions were draining and distressing, for her as well as for me, no doubt, but also very necessary. Stella drove her aggression to the point of collapse until one Tuesday morning she wept silently for 30 minutes. And then, in a whisper redolent with sleeplessness and pain, said, "Who wouldn't leave me? I'm the worst, the very worst." Over the months that followed, Stella entered regions of herself she'd always avoided. Most of all, the child, abandoned to her yearning for a mother's curiosity and attention, and at her rage at the failure to provide it. Abandoned, too, to the crumbs of cheery goodwill her physically and emotionally absent father occasionally sprinkled her way. Max had married her, believing her caustic aggression was just a front, that the tenderness he sometimes glimpsed would win through eventually. In fact, Stella had said yes to him, believing something similar, that her anger would gradually dissipate under the loving gaze of this kind, clever young man. What she hadn't seen until it was too late was how fragile he was emotionally, how inadequately set up to withstand her attacks. He would sulk and pout when I was mean to him, which only spurred me to be meaner still. I don't know why. "I think you do," I said. "You wanted him to ask you what the hell was wrong with you speaking to him like that. To stand up to you, yes, but also really to wonder what was wrong, why you were so angry. You wanted someone different from your parents." But that seemed so unfair. It wasn't his job to work out what was wrong or why I was so angry. "No?" There was a long silence. "I should have come to you years earlier. I might still be married." She paused. "Probably not. We were never right for each other, but the parting could have been much kinder." 6 years after her separation from Max, there was a much kinder parting with me. There was no new love, no Hollywood sunset. She wondered whether she wanted another long-term relationship. "Perhaps one day," she said towards the end, "I'll be able to choose someone because I want to be with them rather than to escape from myself." While she was frequently and no doubt entertainingly wicked, she was never again blindly vicious towards me or anyone else. Instead of incinerating her humour, her rage gave it just enough heat. Being angry, she realised, could be a way of feeling rather than annihilating her feelings. As we moved towards ending our sessions, she began writing a novel based on her marriage. It would be a way to make sense of the work she'd done with me. "I don't know what, if anything, I'll end up doing with it, but I feel like it needs the mask of fiction to make the work we've done here fully real. The difficult bit will be to avoid either exonerating myself or making myself a monster." I agreed. Either option would be an easy way out. "Well, maybe you'll end up in it, the tricky bastard who denied me an easy way out." In a meditation on different forms of human conversation, the French writer and philosopher Maurice Blanchot reflects on the pause the interval between one speaker and another, as the condition that alone permits speech to be constituted as conversation. The pause signifies the recognition of an interlocutor, someone to whom I'm both addressing myself and listening to. It signifies a limit on my power of speech and a basic receptivity to the voice of someone else. Speech without pause, Blanchot continues, raises the spectre of the worst persecutory terror. Let us recall Hitler's terrible monologues, and every head of state participates in the same violence of this diktat, the repetition of an imperious monologue when he enjoys the power of being the only one to speak. To dictate is literally to possess the power of being the only one to speak, and therefore to exclude and negate the possibility of other voices, other ways of perceiving, feeling and thinking. Blanchot's allusion to Hitler is in this sense more than an example. He is the end logic of this violent tearing away of speaking from the pause and so from listening. In effectively abolishing the other's voice, Hitler's raging monologues are a concentrated expression of his murderousness. Blanchot's observation, I suggest, captures the essence of racism both as a personal attitude and as a social structure. Racism is a way of systematically excluding the other from conversation, from the possibility of human recognition and contact. As Hitler's monologues remind us so viscerally, the anger mobilized by racism is indistinguishable from aggression. Even as mere speech, racism's function is to injure, humiliate, and reduce the other. Racism has been the unfortunate occasion for a range of modern writers and thinkers not only to make sense of politically inflected rage of this kind, but to imagine ways of resisting and defeating it, of enlisting anger in the service of love and justice rather than fear and hate. Few writers pursued this task more consistently and substantially than the Black American novelist and essayist James Baldwin. For Baldwin, the relation of Black Americans to America could not be reduced to that of oppressed to oppressor, of master to slave. Indeed, this relationship cannot be understood at all, he writes in his 1951 essay Many Thousands Gone, until we accept how very much it contains of the force and anguish and terror of love. Baldwin points the way here to a different mode of anger, one that breaks out of the sterile rage of the unhearing monologue or rant, placing anger instead on the plane of love, albeit a love heavy with turbulence and ambivalence. The problem, as Baldwin conceives it, is that the grim realities of racial inequality and injustice have trapped Black Americans in the malign projections of American mass psychology, in which Black Americans typically manifest as ticking time bombs of dangerous and vindictive resentment, while their tormented and ambivalent love for America, the only country they have, remains unperceived. Under such conditions, relations between Black and white Americans can only perpetuate mutual fear and suspicion, a point echoed in the writings of his equally celebrated contemporary Frantz Fanon. Writing out of the lived experience of colonialism and the terrible ravages of the Algerian War, the Algerian psychiatrist anatomized the pathological effects of racism on both oppressed and oppressor. As we saw in Chapter 2, Fanon today is often invoked for his advocacy of violent resistance as a cleansing force that, as he writes in The Wretched of the Earth, his seminal 1961 book published shortly after the end of the Algerian War, frees the native from his inferiority complex and from his despair and inaction. It makes him fearless and restores his self-respect. But the broader context of his writing gives us reason to question this apparently unequivocal sanguinity towards violence. Violence, for Fanon, more often appears as the expression of a deep-rooted social pathology, in which human relationships are distorted at the outset by the psychic and institutional structures of racism. As a psychoanalytically oriented psychiatrist, Fanon was especially concerned with the ways racism infiltrated the bodily lives of native Algerians. He notes, "The dreams of the native are always of muscular prowess, of action and of aggression. I dream I am jumping, swimming, running, climbing. I dream that I burst out laughing." This unconscious life of unrestricted bodily freedom is in direct contrast to a daily life in which the native's muscles are always tensed. Muscular tension becomes the body's way of expressing life under siege. At once the fear induced by the police, the military and the whole apparatus of the colonial order, and a coiled preparedness for action against it. The native is an oppressed person whose permanent dream is to become the persecutor. In his clinical discussions later in The Wretched of the Earth, of the pathologies of oppressor and oppressed under colonialism, he notes that a generalized muscular contraction had become an established symptom of native Algerians long before the war. Fanon describes this contraction as the expression in muscular form of his rigidity and his refusal with regard to colonial authority. It can often result, he writes, in a kind of permanent inhibition of release, a stiffening that can find no relief. As one patient puts it, "You see, I'm already stiff like a dead man." Racism creates a perpetual state of internal alert, a deadening feeling of psychic and bodily constriction that infects oppressor as well as oppressed. We meet a police inspector tormented by the urge to hit everybody all of the time, which he visits on his young children and wife, and which is aroused against anyone offering the slightest resistance to his will. I find it hard not to hear an oblique echo of Blanchot's dictator here, a kind of allergenic defence against awareness of any voice, desire or will not his own, as well as a violent denial of his own vulnerability, embodied in the baby of 20 months whom he hits with unaccustomed savagery. We see here the effects of racism above all on the feeling life of those who live in its oppressive grip. The automatic reaching for aggressive action, a kind of spring release of the tightly bound musculature, is a way of evading the feelings of pain, injury and humiliation that afflict oppressor and oppressed alike. The colonial police officer, unable to bear the excessive burden of guilt and shame inherent to his role, begs Fanon to help him go on torturing Algerian patriots without any prickings of conscience, without any behaviour problems and with complete equanimity. Fanon also records the case of two Algerian schoolchildren of 13 and 14 who stabbed to death one of their European schoolfellows. Under Fanon's questioning, both acknowledge the boy was a friend who had done nothing to harm either of them, and both appeal to an abstract logic of redress for the unpunished murder of countless Algerians by the French. When one of the children tells Fanon that they kill children too, Fanon counters that this is no reason to kill their friend. "Well, kill him I did," the child replies. "Now you can do what you like." These studies in the psychopathology of colonialism and racism reveal a society whose capacity for contact with their own and others' psychic states has been fatally corroded. Under these conditions, it is very difficult for anger to take any form other than pure aggression, blind action, dissociated from desire or intent, or from any feeling at all beyond a compulsive pressure to kill the other. It's no accident that Baldwin's discussion of the psychic life of black Americans centres on Richard Wright's seminal 1940 novel Native Son, a book whose central character, Bigger Thomas, could serve as an exemplary case study in this kind of dissociated aggression. In the novel, the impoverished Bigger, seething with rage and envy towards wealthy white society, flees the scene after killing, apparently by accident, the daughter of the rich white family who have just employed him as a chauffeur. While in flight, he rapes and then kills his girlfriend Bessie before finally being captured, tried, and sentenced to death. Baldwin's essay is an appreciative but ultimately unsparing critique of the novel, and in particular what he sees as the one-dimensionality of Bigger's inner life, which comes perilously, if inadvertently close, to confirming some of the most pernicious tropes of white racism. The difficulty, argues Baldwin, is that Wright's portrayal is empathetically not without truth. There is, he writes, no Negro living in America who has not felt, briefly or for long periods, hatred, who has wanted to smash any white face he may encounter in a day, to violate, out of motives of the cruelest vengeance, their women, to break the bodies of all white people, and bring them low as that dust into which he himself has been and is being trampled. Setting aside the conflation of black Americans with black men, Baldwin here confirms the truth of that same dissociated rage we see in Bigger or in Fanon's case studies. But this is a partial truth that loses sight of what this dissociated rage is dissociating itself from. namely the force and anguish and terror of love. This troubled love is an equal part of the Black American experience. As long as it goes unseen and unfelt, the likes of Bigger can only exist as a horrifying warning to the frightened hearts of liberal America. To present Bigger as a warning is simply to reinforce the American guilt and fear concerning him. It is most forcefully to limit him to that social arena in which he has no human validity. It is simply to condemn him to death. Under Wright's gaze, Bigger's rage is too thoroughly saturated with hatred of both himself and others to admit of any other possible end than punishment by death, unforgiving and unforgiven. Racism, the novel seems to conclude, has deprived him of an inner life, which might have afforded him enough contact with his rage to facilitate the stirrings of love and justice. Racist society gives birth to his blind murderousness, and so racist society must kill him. In his later book, The Fire Next Time, 1963, Baldwin asks how we might break out of this cyclical violence which is endemic to a racist world. The first and much shorter of the book's two sections is a letter to his nephew, also named James, on the 100th anniversary of the emancipation. His nephew may have the moody temperament of his late grandfather, Baldwin's preacher father, who died defeated because at the bottom of his heart he really believed what white people said about him. For all that one was a preacher and the other a delinquent youth, there is in this regard an unsettling affinity between Baldwin's father and Bigger. Both are trapped in the projections of racism. If he is to escape this fate, the young James must see what they could not. That what white people believe of him does not testify to your inferiority, but to their inhumanity and fear. Without this insight, words like acceptance and integration are meaningless, for they rest on the impertinent assumption that they, white people, must accept you. On the contrary, Baldwin tells James, you must accept them, and accept them with love. What does it mean to accept white people with love? It is to see what Baldwin calls, with simultaneous sincerity and irony, their innocence, their entrapment inside a history they don't understand, one which has bound them willy-nilly to an ingrained and unquestioned belief in their own superiority. While white and black Americans tacitly collude in this belief, they are bound together in the same deathly fate. White people will continue to delude themselves that the imprisonment of their black brothers and sisters in ghettos has made them safe. And black people will never allow themselves to go behind the white man's definitions. Integration on these terms means merely that you try to become like white people. But there is a different and deeper sense of integration, that we, with love, shall force our brothers to see themselves as they really are, to cease fleeing from reality and begin to change it. What this task of love means can be interpreted many different ways. The sense that may be most relevant to us is of acknowledging fleeing from reality as first of all a state of dissociation, not only from history, but from feeling. White identity, Baldwin suggests, and its assumption of the normativity against which all other identities are judged and measured, is based on an unacknowledged dependence on the history of violence and exclusion it prefers to deny, because to acknowledge that history would be to unsettle reality at its core. The black man has functioned in the white man's world as a fixed star, as an immovable pillar, and as he moves out of his place, heaven and earth are shaken to their foundations. But this assumed normativity has come at a psychic and bodily cost to white as well as black Americans. It has required them to become insensible to centuries of suffering and rage, to all the passions that have shaped American history. And this insensibility, as the word itself suggests, has come to impact white people's relationship to their own sensuality. By sensuality, Baldwin is not conjuring the racially charged spectres of quivering dusky maidens or priapic black studs, but something much simpler and less fanciful. To be sensual, I think, is to respect and rejoice in all the force of life itself, and to be present in all that one does, from the effort of loving to the breaking of bread. Something very sinister happens to the people of a country when they begin to distrust their own reactions as deeply as they do here, and to become as joyless as they have become. When Baldwin observes caustically that white Americans seem to feel that happy songs are happy and that sad songs are sad, he is describing an abstracted psychic state in which the borders of feeling are forever being policed, rigorously if unconsciously, so that if I'm experiencing one feeling, I can't be experiencing another. This artificial marking off of feelings from one another is bound to render feeling itself bloodless and thin. This, perhaps, is the problem with the way black anger circulates in American culture, as a fixed and discrete force, without contamination from other, perhaps quite contradictory feelings, like love. Perceived in this reduced, unambiguous way, anger takes on the status of a warning, a fearful harbinger of aggression and violence that must be ignored or, when necessary, punished. An anger this one-dimensional cannot really be felt in the sense in which I've tried to put across in this book. Whoever expresses it is out of contact with themselves. The problem with Bigger as a character, and indeed the way in which he is most American, writes Baldwin, is that he has no discernible relationship to himself, to his own life, to his own people, nor to any other people. He is precisely a nonsensual anger, an anger that is discharged in aggressive action before it can be contacted and listened to by the self who is feeling it. Aggressive anger, I suggested earlier, depersonalizes the self. Verbal and physical acts of aggression tend to turn the person who performs them into an interchangeable instance of a generalized feeling. When I yell pointlessly through my windscreen at a driver who's just cut me up with a reckless right turn, I'm secretly and unhappily aware that I'd rather hide behind the comical stock figure of a middle-aged road rager than endure the momentary feeling of humiliation hovering unwanted at the edges of my consciousness. If I didn't default so quickly to yelling, in other words, I might be forced to feel something more than a reflexive anger. Lurking beneath that reflex would be, perhaps, feelings of impotence and anxiety, some resentment and even envy at how readily available such aggression is to other, especially younger male drivers, in contrast to the distance and unease I feel in relation to my own aggression, not to mention the sadness I feel at no longer being young. There is, I'm suggesting, a rich but disavowed personal history of feeling that is concealed even beneath the trivial, unseen event of my yelling at a person who can't hear me. Baldwin vastly expands this insight, asking us to see what depths and rich complexities of feeling are hiding inside us all, unheard and unfelt. How transformative might it be for relations between people of different races if those depths could be sounded and heard and received? Baldwin implies that two conditions must be in place to enable such an encounter. There must be a readiness among black Americans to open their white fellow citizens to the reality they've been fleeing from. And there must be white persons able to renounce the willful deafness of the dictator endowed with the sole right of speech and listen to this other voice. There can be no ideal iteration of this kind of encounter because both parties involved will come to it carrying the internalized distortions of racism. This, of course, is what makes the encounter necessary and meaningful in the first place. With that proviso in mind, I turn to the unfolding relationship in 1930s Johannesburg between a Russian Jewish psychoanalyst and a medicine man of the Manyika tribe of eastern Zimbabwe, narrated in Wolf Sachs's remarkable 1947 book Black Anger, with the thought that it might offer a version of Baldwin's imagined encounter. Black Anger is the revision of a book published 10 years previously under the tellingly different title of Black Hamlet. The revisions and change of title attest to a subtle but decisive change in the book's understanding of its own aims and intentions. Where Black Hamlet signals the reading of an African man through a psychoanalytic narrative grid, Black Anger makes audible the feeling voice of the man himself. Born in Lithuania in 1893, Sachs studied psychoneurology under Pavlov in St. Petersburg and took a further degree in Cologne before qualifying as a doctor in London in 1922. Soon after, he emigrated to South Africa with his family, where he became a pioneer of psychoanalysis, publishing an introductory book in 1934 with an approving foreword from Freud. Sachs was an energetic participant in South African left politics, in large part informed by his Jewishness. "Didn't I myself," he reflects in Black Anger, "belong to a people ceaselessly driven from pillar to post?" He edited a socialist journal, The Democrat, from 1943, and was instrumental in founding the South African Psychoanalytical Training Institute in 1946, before his sudden death in 1949. As the South African historian Saul de Beau notes, Black Anger covers a period between the early 30s and the Second World War, during which time racial segregation had become increasingly entrenched in law and fact. John Chavafambira, the Manyika medicine man at the centre of the book, was part of a large migratory movement of rural southern Africans seeking work in rapidly expanding cities. The initial meeting between Sachs and Chavafambira was informed by a fair share of self-interested motives on both their parts. Sachs was introduced to Chavafambira by a woman anthropologist whom de Beau identifies as Ellen Hellman, a fellow participant in Sachs's political and intellectual circles. His aim in making his acquaintance was to understand the black man's mind in its normal state, as a way of testing the cultural generalizability of psychoanalysis. This required a subject willing to meet regularly, to free associate, and so reveal the wide range of desires, conflicts, strivings, contradictory and confusing, without which we cannot hope to understand the depths of the human mind. For his part, Chavafambira hoped to learn something of the European doctor's techniques for treating the human mind and body to develop his own practice as a Nganga or medicine man. Inevitably, his curiosity about Sachs was hedged by ambivalence and a suspicion, hardly unjustified, about his motives. Added to this was the inhibiting effect of Sachs's whiteness on the freedom of his free associations. Free association is bound to run up against the roadblock of inhibition in any analysis, but Sachs was made to recognize how much more difficult it was for John to talk about me and the white people he hated and feared. Sachs is perceptive enough to recognize that these profound differentials in power, added to the cultural and linguistic distance between them, prevent him from conducting anything like an orthodox analysis of Chavafambira. He is flexible enough clinically to do away with some of the most basic features of the psychoanalytic setting, including payment, abstention from self-disclosure, and confinement of contact to the consulting room. Sachs visits all the locales of Chavafambira's working and domestic life and history, and as their intimacy deepens, shares his thoughts and feelings while intervening increasingly concretely in Chavafambira's life problems and dilemmas. And Sachs is sufficiently self-examining to recognize that his native subject's suspicion of him is all too well-founded. He mistrusted every white man, for he fully realized that a white man always wanted to get something out of a black. The truth is, he was quite right in that respect. For a long time, John was to me merely an object for psychological study. There is an anticipation here, directed towards himself, of Ferrante's criticism of the psychoanalytic tendency towards understanding, the temptation to render the disordered reality of the inner life as a coherent narrative. Sachs's admission of his incapacity to see Chavafambira as other than an object for psychological study hints at the temptation to squeeze his subject's life into the confines of a particular narrative grid. The admission is also implicit in the change of title, from Black Hamlet to Black Anger. The earlier title had placed the emphasis on Chavafambira's Hamletism, a variation on the Oedipus complex identified by Freud in the interpretation of dreams. Like Hamlet, the young medicine man is filled with a murderous resentment towards the uncle suspected of poisoning his father and usurping his place, and is afflicted with the same indecision and hesitancy in situations requiring direct action. But in forging these striking parallels, Sachs passes over the many ways Chavafambira's story eludes and exceeds the tight bounds of the Hamlet narrative. In changing the title, Sachs shifts the book's emphasis from his interpretation of the man to the man's own feeling life, from a ready-made explanation of Shavafambira's anger to listening to it on its own terms. The book Sacks intended to write, a psychoanthropological study of the mental effects of an African medicine man's migration from a rural kraal or village to a major city, morphs as he writes it into a story of the transformative effects on his own mind of his relationship with Shavafambira. The ambition to find out the workings of the primitive unconscious mind, which involves examining that mind from a conceptual distance, gives way to a realization of how he and Shavafambira are each being changed by their relationship. The pivotal moment here comes when Sacks notices the correlation between Shavafambira's increasing self-destructiveness and his abrupt severance from me. Their meetings had become infrequent as Shavafambira was building his practice. Sacks notes that with a conventional analytic patient, he would have been fully aware of the risks of breaking off contact while the patient was in the state of so-called positive transference to the analyst. But he failed to account for this danger when it came to Shavafambira because, I had to confess again, John had been to me only a subject of experiment, and the whole analysis nothing more than a case of psychic vivisection. By providing regular confirmation of his psychoanalytic intuitions, the medicine man had long been an abundant source of narcissistic gratification for Sacks. But faced with the prospect of real risk to Shavafambira's well-being and safety, Sacks begins to discern the emergence of a new man, not the case study, but the human, the real John. It isn't a matter here of Sacks throwing off at a stroke all the prejudices and distortions of a racialized way of seeing. In fact, he continues to betray these prejudices in ways he isn't always aware of. He can be patrician and high-handed in his dealings with black men and women, and never questions his assumptions of European superiority in intellectual and aesthetic judgment. When Shavafambira becomes infatuated with a young woman in his kraal, Sacks expresses admiration for her exceptional beauty, judged even by European standards. But Sacks's continued and unavoidable embeddedness in the racism which conditions his daily life is an important element in the story of his faltering transformation. A Jew growing up during the twilight of Tsarist Russia, he bears within himself both the historical legacy of anti-Semitism and the social, economic, and legal privileges of whiteness in southern Africa. His Jewishness attunes him to the rage and fear aroused in him by his black interlocutors, by his whiteness. Through all his years of dialogue with Shavafambira, Sacks is continually honing his receptivity to what his informant is telling him, above all, about black anger. He comes to see that something in its force and intensity can't be contained inside the standard psychoanalytic frame. Immersing himself in the various communities Shavafambira moves between, he learns more of the rage and humiliation accrued by black South Africans in the course of their daily lives. When Sacks visits Shavafambira in the impoverished Blacktown settlement, a pseudonym for the Orlando neighborhood in Soweto, the medicine man tells the assembled company about going to buy a train ticket at Benoni Station 1 hour in advance of travel to allow himself a little time to rest beforehand. "You Kaffirs get enough rest, lazy bastards," the vendor tells him, slamming the window shut. When Shavafambira returns an hour later, he is made to wait while white customers buy their tickets and so misses his train. It is an incident to set alongside a story of Shavafambira's educated friend Tembu, a response to Sacks's question as to whether Tembu considers him to be a real friend of the Africans. Tembu relates his visit to a wealthy white liberal's house to hear him declaim against the new native laws depriving Africans of their last vestiges of human rights. Following the talk, Tembu asks for the toilet, only for the white speaker to direct him past the house toilet to one in the servants' quarters, a dirty, foul-smelling latrine. "I ask you, Doctor, what are we to think?" Bearing witness to the sheer relentlessness of such unthinking racism in everyday black life, Sacks comes to see that the humiliation related in Tembu's story is structural rather than incidental. The assumption of black inferiority is woven into the texture of daily life, unquestioningly assumed by whites, resentfully suffered by blacks. This is why he can't, in any conventional sense, conduct an analysis of Shavafambira. The power differential intrinsic to the relation between analyst and patient is operative only within the consulting room. Psychoanalysis tacitly assumes the social and legal equality of the two participants outside the room. If this is absent, as we've seen, it erodes the possibility of free association and of the development of a transference, that is, of anxieties, beliefs, and fantasies about the analyst based in psychic rather than external reality. When Sachs accompanies Shavafambira to his kraal in Manikaland, the fortnight of sharing the intimacies of daily living, a sleeping area, meals, social visits, breaks down the barriers between them. But their return to Johannesburg and its conventions regulating black and white relationships quickly restores them. They can no longer be companions, nor psychoanalyst and subject. Shavafambira, Sachs concludes, was never a patient. He cannot be said to suffer from characterological deficiencies, but only from his whole life situation, produced by the society in which he lived. John's greatest need was not to know more of his repressed unconscious, but to know the society he lived in, to recognize its ills and to learn how to fight them. The key finding of a book by a white psychoanalyst on black anger is that black anger can't be psychoanalyzed, that its sheer quantity and force overwhelm the psychoanalytic conceptual grid. It is as though Sachs and Shavafambira have together executed the painful and difficult task formulated 16 years later by Baldwin, that we, with love, shall force our brothers to see themselves as they are, to cease fleeing from reality and begin to change it. What is it about this record of a relationship forged over 8 decades ago that speaks so resonantly to our own moment? Prejudice and oppression today no longer require a cumbersome legal apparatus. Apartheid has ended. Civil rights have been advanced. States and institutions may be slowly and falteringly coming to terms with their racist and colonial histories. Waves of feminist activism, up to and including the Me Too movement, have shaken the legal and institutional foundations of sexism. We can point to similar achievements in the movements for gay and trans rights, not to mention the fight for a livable planet. In each of these fields of activism, we have seen anger successfully mobilized in the service of love and justice. And yet, our civil societies are being torn asunder in new ways by forces intent on unleashing on the world a reactive rage against these social and political advances. So-called populist parties, candidates and movements harness their massive monopolies of attention across conventional and social media to arouse and disseminate paranoia and hate against the enemies who have dared to question and agitate against existing social and political arrangements. The ultimate imperative of these populist movements is to insulate their constituencies from other voices, to ensure that every one of their followers internalizes the dictator who alone has the right to speak. The result is an effective prohibition on listening to anyone or anything who questions their entrenched and immovable rightness. In an atmosphere like this, speaking anger from across an apparently unbridgeable divide to an ear that tries to receive it seems like at once the quietest and most transformative event imaginable.